Music by Art Jarvinen, Endless Bummer, Part 3.
That's for music for Bennett Surf, is that what he said?
Bennett Surf Band.
Yeah.
Boys, okay. Surf Band, right. Boys, mm-hmm. Something.
Okay. And?
And!
You want me to tell you something about it?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why you're here. You're going to elucidate and inform.
Well, Endless Bummer is a series of pieces on that particular CD. There are three of them, parts 1, 2, and 3, but presented in reverse order, mm-hmm. just because it makes more sense that way as a listening experience, I think.
Okay.
But I think there may be 2 or 3 more in the series that I've written. They came about because I had a friend named Randy Hostetler who died unexpectedly at the age of 32, and I had written a short memorial piece for him, like the day that I heard that news. And then a while later, a couple of years after that, I happened to be thinking about him, and I realized it was his birthday or the anniversary of his death or something. I think maybe it was his birthday. And Randy was on my mind, and so I wanted to write something else, just kind of to honor him, sort of another short memorial piece. And so that's how Endless Bummer came around. Mm-hmm. It relates very directly to when Randy was living in L.A. and he had this ongoing series of concerts at his house called the Living Room Series.
Right.
One of the things, I went to one of these living room concerts, and down the steps to the bottom of the yard in this little grove of trees, a couple of musician friends of his were playing the theme from Endless Summer. And they basically played it all evening long, just drums and guitar. Mark Lightcap was playing guitar and Steve Goodfriend was playing drums. And there were just, people would come and go and take their food down there. And they just created this beautiful atmosphere of the theme from Endless Summer being played over and over and mm-hmm. over again, just, all night long. And so I was motivated to write my own little piece in that spirit. And so I got out my VHS copy of Endless Summer, the movie, and played the opening theme music about a dozen times, I think. I just absorbed, just
imprinted
this,
it completely.
This theme.
You became the Endless Summer.
I became the theme from Endless Summer by the Sandals. And then I went in my studio and sat down at the piano and tried to write something exactly like it. And I ended up with something that is not at all like it, but definitely captures the mood and feeling and spirit of, what is one of the few sort of surf ballads,
mm-hmm,
And it turns out that without sort of analyzing it or thinking about it, in any real intellectual way, just listening to that theme over and over again and then trying to write my own piece that would kind of emulate it in some way, it turns out, I realized later, that the Sandals theme starts on a D chord and goes down to C and just kind of goes back and forth, except for the bridge. Most of the tune is just built on D major, C major, D major, C major. And my Endless Bummer Part 1 goes from F sharp to E, F sharp to E, F sharp to E. I guess I did sort of just absorb just enough to really suggest the whole, structure and feeling of the what I was trying to emulate. But of course, the music I came up with doesn't sound like a parody or a copy.
No, not at all. It doesn't sound like a parody at all, no.
So that's kind of how that piece came about. And then I liked the idea of this guitar and bass, or two guitars, just doing this repetition and variation, these pieces based on some sort of mantra, that just kind of keeps going on with more through-composed material, in the melodic part. And so I've just, every once in a while, I revisit that idea. I sort of consider it an open-ended project. I can sit down and write another Endless Bummer installation anytime I feel like it.
Which you have done on someone else's music, on Satie's Vexations.
Oh, yes, I've written a few variations on Vexations.
Yeah, rather than me sort of read the jacket notes on this one, why don't you give a background? This is a really intriguing concept. It's Satie in extremis in a sort of way.
Yeah, there's a pianist who is American but living in Paris named Guy Livingston. And around 1995 or 96, no, a little later than that, 97 maybe, late 90s, Guy sent out a call for submissions. He wanted solo piano works that were no more than 60 seconds long. And they could be, as short as 1 second, but the upper limit was 60 seconds.
Yes.
So I decided, to enter a piece, you know, see if he would accept this submission of mine. And I was thinking, okay, if I'm going to write such a short piano solo, I think it should be based on the longest piano solo I can think of. I should do a variation on the longest piano piece that I'm aware of. And immediately, you know, that to me was Vexations of Erik Satie, which is 840 literal repetitions of the same motif. And depending on how you interpret très long, you know, very slow, its typical performances last from between 18 to 24 hours.
Right.
You know, there's no literal tempo marking, but, you know, if you play it pretty slow, you're going to clock in pretty close to 24 hours. So I thought that's a pretty long piano solo, you know, 24 hours. I couldn't think of any that's much longer than that. So I thought, okay, I'll do a variation on Vexations. And I took the three-note harmonies of Vexations and collapsed them, every other one together, to make six-note chords. And if you play that motif of Satie's, collapsed into, you know, hexachords, takes about a minute if you time it right. And so that became Hexations, with a little text that goes with it. The pianist plays the music and reads this little commentary I made about the length of musical pieces. And my opinion being that for the most part, pieces that are extremely long are arbitrarily so. Like the late works of Feldman, for example, mm-hmm. got longer and longer yes. and longer. And it's my considered opinion that the extreme length of those pieces is arbitrary, in that they got longer and longer just because he had to make the next one longer than the one before.
Yes.
So that's what how Hexations works. Turns out I submitted it, and Guy either just didn't notice it or it didn't make the first cut or whatever, but it never got played. But in the meantime, it didn't really matter much to me, because once I had written the first variation of Vexations, I realized immediately, my composer brain said, okay, now, Art, you're just getting started. There's 840 repetitions of Vexations, so now you have to write 840 variations. So you have kind of a parallel piece.
And it was performed, in fact.
Yeah, so the piece is 840 variations on Vexations. And it takes 24 hours to play, and it has been done at the Kitchen in New York and at an art gallery in Los Angeles. So I've gotten two full performances of that piece.
And you said, I believe in your notes, that they were pianists in shifts.
Yeah, people, typically when Satie's piece is played, one single pianist doesn't do it from beginning to end. Although that has been attempted, and probably at this point in history, it probably has been done. But usually the tradition is to take turns. That tradition was established by John Cage when he premiered Vexations in New York, and people took turns. And so with my piece, it made sense to have 16 or 18 pianists do shifts, and that's how it's been done.
Let's hear part of it. Shall we start at the beginning, or shall we start in some middle section?
Just arbitrarily drop the needle. Yeah.
Oh, drop the needle.
Drop the needle on a CD.
Like, yeah. So let's choose. I don't know. We'll do some arbitration here mm-hmm. first. All right. Here we go. An excerpt from these variations on Vexations called "Serious Immobilities."
Thank you.
About a dozen of the 84 variations on this CD of Serious Immobilities from a total of 840 variations on the music of Eric Satie. You're just sitting stunned.
Oh, I thought I wanted to hear more. There weren't enough. I was just getting started.
I'll loan you this.
Oh, thanks ever.
Our guest is Art Jervinen. Did you write that on paper? With a pencil?
Yes, with a Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 soft. The only pencil I will compose with because it has the best eraser.
I will give you a photograph of a Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil poster I have from a long time ago. You'll very much enjoy it. You'll meditate on it. Let's change tone entirely.
Okay.
We started out talking about how you had a very diverse way of working, and so far we've heard slow tunes. So let's hear something
another
a little bit
slower?
More. Well, maybe not so much slow, but a little bit more in a different approach entirely. Okay. And I think we've got something queued up here from Nighthawks.
Okay,
and you have this fantastic, of course, Nighthawks, the copy of the sort of painting on the cover of the CD. It's one of my favorite, absolute favorite paintings.
You like how I stuck myself in the diner?
I didn't see you. Oh, there you are. I didn't notice that over on it. I thought you were a smudge, Art Smudge. So tell a little bit about Nighthawk, about Nighthawks.
I love that painting, the Nighthawks by Edward Hopper. And I like Hopper's work in general, but of course that's the one he's most, best known for. And for some reason, just one of those, composer's intuition, not some, buddy telling you, I would like a piece like this, or some intellectual idea. Just looking at that painting one day, it occurred to me, wouldn't it be cool to have that diner be on stage and be sort of the central set or the point of departure for a series of pieces, songs or compositions based on Hopper paintings. And so I had this idea, going through my mind for a long time, tried to get funding for it, couldn't do it. And I, write most of my music for free, but with major productions, big song cycles or, a major piece, I usually try to at least, see if there's some way to get something like that funded. And I was just getting nowhere and figured, well, the piece is never going to get written. I shelved it basically in my mind. And then, lo and behold, somebody encouraged me to apply for a City of Los Angeles Individual Artist Fellowship. So I proposed Nighthawks, and I got it. Uh-huh. So in 2002, I was a COLA fellow funded by the City of Los Angeles and got a nice, chunk of change, 10 grand, to do whatever I wanted. So I wrote Nighthawks, which is 11... So it's a stage song cycle based on, and every song is based on my impression, my responses to Hopper paintings. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I never really expected to happen, I figured I'd meditate on these paintings, pick the ones that speak to me the most and start to give me musical ideas, and I would basically be writing fictions. And it turns out that as I, got down to my short list of paintings and started writing what came to mind, it turned out to be a very, very predominantly autobiographical work. Which I had not, it blindsided me, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I did not expect to reveal that much of myself in this piece. So what we're going to hear is the piece is written for myself as the person speaking and singing. I also used a female singer, a friend of mine, Toby Holmes, playing upright bass and trombone and euphonium, Milan Kirov on keyboards, Matt Gurman on guitars. So very, very small ensemble, very intimate. And we did have the diner set, which I built, a life-size replica the Nighthawks diner that was on stage. And so what we're going to hear is this second song in the piece called No One Lives There Now. And it's based on the painting Railroad Crossing, which basically just shows the small country road coming to a place where it crosses a railroad, and there's a big sort of Victorian style, three-story house right there near the railroad crossing.
Our guest is Art Jervinen.
In northern town you've never heard of, where people no one's ever heard of live. And there's a house down by the railroad that could tell a lot of stories. Some of them I wish I could forget, and some of it I guess I should forgive. I used to live there, but no one lives there now. I used to live there, but no one lives there now.
Music by Art Jarvinen, and the second voice there, Kira Volman?
Yes.
Yeah, very good.
Sorry, I forgot to mention her by name when you're setting things up.
Yeah, that's Nighthawks from a performance in 2003.
I believe so, with one broken microphone.
So that kind of gives a little hollow feeling.
Yeah,
it's a little bit more melancholy than it probably was composed to sound.
Yeah, it's a little more lively in live performance.
But the performance wasn't part of the grant?
The COLA grants are structured that they give you a bunch of money to produce and create and present. Uh-huh. So you're obligated to actually do an exhibition or a concert or a dance performance or whatever your medium is, but you can divvy up the money any way you want to. So it was one of those fortunate instances where I was able to actually do something like, oh, pay musicians. You know, what a concept, huh? Ooh,
that's a good concept. We like that.
Except when we have to pay them out of whatever.
Oh, no. We never.
So, of course, you know, you could just, like, take all the money and keep it and do a solo performance. But I saw this as an opportunity to do something that, like I said, I had tried to get funded many times, many ways. And so, yeah, like that.
How about something from, we opened with Vulture's Garden. Let's listen to that now, because there's a completely a different approach to your composition. Tell us something about how you went about writing that.
The Vulture's Garden specifically?
Yeah, that specifically.
That was a commission from Zeitgeist when it was still Joe Holmquist and a few other people from Minnesota. Jay Johnson, Joe and Jay were the percussionists, and Bob Samarato played multiple woodwinds, and I'm just embarrassed and sorry to say I can't remember the piano player's name at the moment. But Zeitgeist still exists, but it's a completely different group, different personnel, different instrumentation. But at the time, it was a very strange ensemble, two percussion, piano, and woodwinds, and they did a lot of commissioning. Funding for new music and commissions and so forth in Minnesota has always been pretty good. And so they were able to commission quite a number of works. And they came to me and said, you know, we want a piece, but they were very particular about what they wanted from me. They wanted four short pieces that could be played together as a movements of a single work, but they could be played together that way, or all four could be separated throughout a concert. Or they could just play one or two as an encore piece or as a setup for an opening. You know, they just wanted something very flexible in terms of the structure and form of the piece itself. Other than that, I could write whatever I wanted. But you can imagine with an instrumentation like two percussion, piano, and woodwinds, most of the Zeitgeist repertoire got played by Zeitgeist and no one else.
Tell me about the composition, though. This is... particularly the opening piece, The Vulture's Garden, is very energetic, but at the same time, it feels bigger than the octaves that go on would suggest. How did you go about writing a piece like this?
Well, I don't know why it feels bigger, but I mean, it feels big because there's so many, the same thing is happening in so many octaves.
Yeah.
But overall, what I did, if you... One thing you may have already noticed, and as we play more of my music, or you listen to more of it on your own, you will see that my music very much, much of it comes down to the idea of repetition and variation. 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 These are, you know, very,
I think I've learned this from Monty Python.
Underpinnings. And Schoenberg, according to Cage, Schoenberg defined music. He said, music is repetition and variation. Music is repetition and variation. And variation is also repetition, with some things changed and others not. So once I ran across that quote and started thinking about my own work, I realized, boy, that's true of maybe not music in general, but it certainly is of mine. You know, the way I put together my music, you know, the nuts and bolts of it very often is repetition, variation at the heart of it. And The Vulture's Garden is a very good example of that, because the music starts with the first movement, which is the theme. It's everyone playing in melody, in unison. There's only melody. There's no harmonic components or extra rhythms or anything. It's just unison ensemble playing, just like that one movement of Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time. And many new music composers seem to attempt that at some point. You know, everybody's got their unison piece, it seems, because it's such a cool thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know? It's just... exceptionally cool. So yeah, I couldn't resist. But it makes sense in this case, because what I did in each of the subsequent variations is derive all of the harmonies and counterpoint and different layers and textures and everything. The music gets increasingly complicated in terms of its surface qualities, but it all comes from this initial melody. So this, in a sense, is the theme that sets up these other movements, which are sort of repetitions and variations of that same material. So the melody is always there throughout the four movements mm-hmm. of the work. It's always there, but it gets increasingly convoluted and harder to recognize or harder to track because of the various composerly, you know, clever things that I subject it to sort of decompose it as we mm-hmm. progress mm-hmm. through the composition. I've been influenced a lot by, you know, Shevsky in terms of his use of easy to track processes. You know, Shevsky likes simple number games like 1, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4,
right.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
We're talking about Frederick Krzyzewski. You go back in the Kalvasandavian archives and hear our interview with him about 10 years ago now.
So in The Vulture's Garden Part 1, which is actually the title movement, it's called The Vulture's Garden, basically you just get the theme laid out for you, and then it gets whittled away, you know, one fragment at a time until it disappears and gets kind of pulled inside out, and you hear it kind of in retrograde. So it's a very simple, very obvious ripoff of, you know, Shevsky's process techniques from the 70s.
Let's hear the whole thing. What do you think?
I think... Oh, you mean in retrograde? Do you want to play the third movement first, and then the...
Not this time. We'll play it in the order specified by the composer very carefully on this recording. This is the California Ear Unit recording, not the one you were talking about initially. And they do a pretty darn good job.
Oh, yes. Excellent job.
Here we go. The music is by Art Jarvin.